Thank you. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful alcoholic. And that wasn't always the case. my sobriety date is November 17th, 1987. I have a home group, Rich Haven Splinter. I live out in Queens. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and we both use them. Wasn't always the case, but certainly is today. First, I want to say, I don't know, I walked into this meeting tonight knowing that I was to come share my experience, strength, and hope. The information that I got was, and make sure that you talk about the magical experience of how the 12 steps have been manifest, whatever it is, whatever it said. And I had to laugh when I got that a little bit, but the reality is it's the absolute truth. When I walked in tonight, I overheard that there are some people in the room that are really suffering tonight due to the loss of a loved one. And I don't know the people, I don't know the ones that we lost, but here's what I do know. I know that as a result of me working a program today, I have a power greater than myself that can walk me through anything. And I don't have to pick up and I don't have to use today. That's what I know. So that out of the way, you can tell by my accent, I'm not from New York. I was born and raised in Texas. Typical alcoholic home, dysfunctional home. I had one big problem that, actually a multitude of problems, but it kind of all manifests itself into one little thing. I was a lying, cheating, stealing, thieving whore. You know? Oh, I can tell some of you were too. And that's the absolute truth. And as a result, from the very first time I picked up my first drink, my first drug, that really began to manifest itself. From the very first time I picked up a drink, I drank alcoholically. From the moment I started drinking, I drank alcoholically. I also was a blackout drinker. From the very first time I picked up a drink, I drank to blackout. I didn't know that anyone else, that you did it any different than that. I thought everyone blacked out when they drank. But I don't want to spend an enormous amount of time on my drunkalog because the war stories, you know, you have them, I have them, we all have them. I belong here. But the one story I do want to tell you, because I think it is important that I don't ever forget it, bless you, is my last drunk. I heard a speaker say at a conference, at an AA conference, or I think it was Roundup or something, she said, I hope I never get so clean that I forget how dirty I used to be. And I love that. So I always share my last drunk. When I got sober, right before I hit my bottom, I was working in a nightclub in Dallas. And I was a piano player, entertainer, singer, played the piano and sang, you know, it's kind of that whole Larry Lounge Lizard kind of thing in a cabaret, a piano bar. And I sat behind the piano and sang, and people put tips in my tip jar. And one particular night, I was off. And as was always the case when I wasn't working, I was still at the bar. Someone else was performing, and that's what we did on our nights off. We just went to the bar and we drank because we got to drink free. And for an alcoholic, that is like manna from heaven. So I would go to the bar and I would drink on my nights off. And this one particular night, I remember being in the bar. It was called the Hideaway Lounge. How perfect is that, right? The Hideaway Lounge. I remember it was about 10 o'clock at night. And it was one of those bars. It was a small dive bar, had a, you know, lot of wood paneling, and it was just disgusting. But it had behind the bar, it had a mirror, and it had all the bottles sitting up behind the mirror, or in front of the mirror. And I remember sitting at a bar stool, looking at my reflection in the mirror, and I was drunker than shit. And I remember thinking, I've made it. I have made it. I am sitting in a bar in Dallas, Texas, and I am one of the entertainers at this club, and I get to drink free, and we go out onto the patio and get high, and I mean, I made it. I finally had arrived. I remember thinking that. That's what I thought when I looked in the mirror and I saw my reflection. The next thing that I remembered, I was standing in the middle of my living room floor in my apartment. It was 2:30 in the morning, and I had nothing on but a jock strap. Now, lying, cheating, stealing, thieving, whore. Let's talk about that piece for a minute. There was a park that was about 4 blocks from my apartment that it was known for, let's just call it, late night shenanigans. And I'm one of those people, I don't know about any of you, but I'm one of those alcoholics that most of the time alcohol filled that void, but not all of the time. There were some times that there were other things that I had to have to fill that void, that deep hole inside of me. For me, it was sex. I needed to fill that void with as much sex as I could possibly have. And so when I come to this night, my living room, 2:30 in the morning, nothing on but a jock strap, all I could think of was get in my car, go to the park, and get laid. So that's what I did. I grabbed my car keys, I walked out my front door, I walked through my apartment complex, I get in the car, and I punch, and as I'm, I had backed in, so I was ready to kind of take off out of the parking space, I punched the accelerator, came out of the parking lot, and when I did, there was a big dip coming out of the parking lot, I lost control of the car, and I ran into the curb across the street, and instantly, the very first thing I heard was I heard my hubcap pop off. So I threw the car in park, and I get out of the car, and I'm walking around the front of the car. Now, remember, I'm basically naked, right? And I'm walking around the car, and I'm like looking for my, where's my hubcap? You know how we do, you know? Alcohol, insanity. Just like it was a movie, there was a sidewalk, and from out of the blue, this guy comes walking towards me out of the darkness. And as he gets closer, I could tell he's carrying my hubcap. He walks up to me, he hands me the hubcap, turns around, and walks off. He doesn't say a word. Not one word. I mean, what could he say? I must have had enough wherewithal in me at that moment that I realized that I wasn't going to make it to the park. Because I looked down and I saw that in addition to the hubcap popping off, I had bent the rim on the wheel and the tire was flat. So I threw the hubcap in the passenger seat, got back in the car, threw it in reverse and backed it up on a rim into the parking spot, went upstairs, passed out, woke up the next morning, remembered nothing. Remembered nothing. I was working, also I had a day job as well. I worked in the World Trade Center in Dallas. I managed a wholesale furniture showroom. And I put on my suit, got up, got showered, put on my suit, walked downstairs. And I walked out and I saw the flat tire. And I thought, how did that happen? You know, and I remember doing that a lot. How did that happen? How did I wind up in strange places with strange people in strange positions? How did this happen again? As a result of alcohol and blackout drinking, I did that a lot. At that exact same time, I had a really good friend of mine who was another entertainer in the club, and the bar or the courts in Dallas had told him that it was time after 6 Deweys that it was time for him to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So he comes to me and he says, I got to go to AA. I don't want to go by myself. Will you go with me? And I said, sure, I'm not an alcoholic, but I'll go with you. I mean, dude, what? I had all kinds of history to prove that I had a drinking problem, but I wasn't willing to admit it. So we went to our first meeting, and we got in the car, and we drove about 30 miles away from Dallas because we didn't want to have anyone seeing us walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We walk into this AA, and it was in a strip shopping center, and we walk in. The windows were frosted. We walk in the door. I walk in first. Steve walks in behind me, And there was an old man, he must have been 90 if he was a day. He walks up to me and he goes, "Hi, my name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic. Are you an alcoholic?" I said, "No, I'm not, but he is." And, you know, God works in mysterious ways. Even at that time in my life, Bob looked at me and he said, "This is a closed meeting of AA for people who have a desire to stop drinking. What I'd like to do is I'd like to give you this beginner's packet." It was a white envelope that had some pamphlets and things in it. "What I'd like to ask you to do is to take this packet and come back and pick your friend up in an hour." I said, "Okay." Steve was cool with it, so I let him stay, and I got in the car and started driving around. And I remember about 15 minutes after driving around, I finally pulled into an apartment parking lot, or it was a parking lot somewhere, just to smoke a cigarette, and I looked down and I saw on the seat that envelope. And I thought, okay, let's check this out. So I opened up that envelope and I pulled out the first pamphlet that I saw. And it's not called this anymore, but it used to be called the 44 Questions. And I thought, okay, you know what? Let's just take this test. So I started up at the top and worked my way down. And by the time I was done, 42 of 44 were yes. It was in that moment that my alcoholic denial began to break, because I could no longer, with me and nobody else, I finally was beginning to tell the truth. We ended up going to another meeting, we found a meeting that was closer to home the next night. On night 8, Steve comes to me and he says, "You know, I don't think I'm going to go. I don't think I'm going to go anymore." I said, "But kind of don't you have to because of the courts?" He said, "I'll deal with that." He said, "I don't really want to go." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because I can't deal with the God thing." You know, down in Texas, God's a really big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really big deal. And we talk a lot about God in the South. And I kind of walked into AA with a okay relationship with God. I was raised a Christian. I am now recovering from that. I thank God. I walked into AA with knowledge of what God could be. And I'm grateful that the book, the first 164 pages of our book, taught me that I get to redevelop what that looks like for me. I get to develop my own concept of God. I'm really, really grateful for that. Steve couldn't handle it. And I said, "You know what? Okay, great. You go and I will." I said, "You stop going. I'm going to continue to go. I hope you don't mind." He said, "I don't have a problem at all." I'm really, really grateful that God used Steve to get me into the rooms, because he's dead today. This disease, this illness killed him. Took an amazing life, as it takes so many. I'm convinced today that God used Steve to get me into the rooms. I wish that I could say when I first came in that I embraced the steps. I wish I could say I embraced service. I wish I could say I embraced just about anything, but I didn't. I showed up. I did go to a lot of meetings. I did my 90 and 90. I got a temporary sponsor. He gave me my first big book. And I remember one of the very first assignments that he gave me when he gave me my book was, he said, "I want you to go home and I want you to read Bill's story. And when you're done reading it, call me back and set an appointment and you can come over to my apartment and we'll talk about it." I said, "Okay, great." Because at that point, I was kind of ready to at least listen. Maybe you guys, I loved the feeling I had when I walked into these meetings. I loved the smiles on your faces. I loved the glow in your eyes. I loved how you hugged each other. I loved that. I'm a joiner. I've always wanted to be part of a community. So I love that. But I wasn't all that ready to do the work. But I did what he said, and so I went home and I read Bill's story, and I called him, set an appointment, went back over to his apartment, and the very first words out of his mouth were, he said, "Okay, so what'd you think? What'd you think?" And I said, "Can I tell you the truth?" And he said, yeah, it's all I want is the truth. I said, it was the most boring story I've ever read in my life. I have nothing in common with this man. 1930s, New York, remember I'm in Texas, New York, stockbroker, married, straight. I have nothing in common with this man. He smiled and he looked at me and he said, I want you to go home and I want you to read it again. This time, I want you to look, I'll never forget this. He said, this time I want you to look for the similarities. I said, you are not listening to me. Dude, I have nothing in common with this man. He said, the only reason that you believe that is because you are looking at all of the geography. How he drank, where he drank, how much he drank, who he drank with, when he drank. What I want you to do is I want you to go back and I want you to see if you can identify and find the similarities on how you felt, the same way Bill Wilson felt. Bill calls it pitiful and comprehensible demoralization. The four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. The pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, when I went back and read it with that set of eyes, just like the promises tell us, before I was amazed before I was halfway through. I saw my story. Bill's story and my story are identical. I felt exactly like he did. That was my first foray into the book. And it was the first time that I was able to have any identification with that book. You know, if I can stay sober until the 17th of next month, I'll have 28 years. And over that 28, thank you. I say that only to lay the groundwork of how I didn't do it right. You know, I spent the majority of my recovery just kind of showing up and kind of just, yeah, I went to a lot of meetings, but, you know, I didn't do service. I didn't give back. We were talking, Martin and I were talking before the meeting started. I heard someone say not long ago that if you're not doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're a thief. You're stealing from AA. All I wanted to do was just show up and take. I wanted to take. And I called it, I go to meetings and they feed me. I'm spiritually fed when I go to AA meetings. Well, you know what? That was true, but I wasn't giving anything back. I wasn't doing my part. You guys loved me. Oh, the other thing that I think it's important that I tell you about is that for the first 16 months that I walked into the rooms, I actually came in July of 86. For the first 16 months, I continued to smoke pot. That marijuana maintenance thing that you hear a lot about. I continue to smoke pot because somewhere in the book, I swear I saw it. I haven't been able to find it since. But then I swear I saw where it said, whatever it takes. I thought I saw the phrase, whatever it takes. And for me, at that time, to put down the alcohol, it was I needed to hold on to the marijuana. I used to say, if I can have, because give me my piano, my Coca-Cola, my cigarettes, and my joints, and my marijuana, and I'm going to be fine. I don't ever have to drink ever again. And it will never, ever lead me to anything else. I'm fine just doing that. On November the 16th of 1987, I was sitting in a club in Dallas with some friends of mine, and we were listening to another entertainer perform, and we walked out the door, the back door of the club, and my friend that I was with was a big cokehead, and cocaine was never one of my drugs of choice. I didn't see spending that much money to be more intense than I already am. You know, it just made no sense to me. But he pulled that vial of cocaine out of his pocket and handed it to me, and before I knew it, it was up my nose. And I'm convinced that I would not have done that had I not been also smoking pot. If I had been sober, really, truly sober, that probably wouldn't have happened. But I'm a big believer that everything happens exactly like it's supposed to. I finally got honest, and on November 17th of 87, I started working this program to the very best of my ability. And I have misstepped along the way, but I do believe in service. I believe in giving back. I am currently sitting, I have a service commitment as your area chair for CINI. For Southeastern New York. It's a 2-year commitment, and I was elected by the body, and although my service sponsor tells me all the time, screw them, you were elected by God. God gave you this job. Show up for God. Forget all those other idiots. And sometimes you people are idiots. But I have to tell you, giving back to the fellowship has been the thing that has saved my life. You guys have loved me even when I didn't love myself. And there was a long period of time where I didn't love myself. Showing up and doing service, giving back to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is what has truly opened up my heart. I've met some of the most amazing people doing service in AA. People who just want to give back, people who want to help, and have taught me what it means to want to do something without needing anything in return, just so I can help another still suffering alcoholic. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are probably my saving grace. They are the thing that has saved me. If you're new, if you're coming back, I can't tell you how powerful those 12 steps are. My grand sponsor has 55 years in this program, and he tells me all the time, he reminds me all the time, he's like, Rick, you don't work the steps. You don't work the steps. Bill Wilson even says it in the first 164 pages. We take the steps, just like we take a pill. We take a step one at a time. And, you know, having people in my life that have kind of helped clarify a lot of the craziness that is in the first 164 pages, because Bill Wilson sometimes wrote like a maniac. I don't understand half of the words that he writes. I have a dictionary everywhere I go, and when I'm working with a sponsee, even working with my sponsor, we will stop and look up words and write the definitions in the book so that I can remember what it really means, so that it makes sense to me. The thing that changed my life was when that book began to become real to me. You know, I have a God in my life today as a result of the 12 steps, me taking the 12 steps. I have friends in my life today as a result of me taking the 12 steps. I have traveled all over the world. I have a job today that I love. I work for myself. I've worked for myself for the last 16 years. I'm a teacher of sorts, and I love what I do. I have had the opportunity to travel to 44 countries on 4 continents as a result of what I have learned in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what? That's just cash and prizes. For me, the best thing that I got was the joy that I feel in my heart, the peace that I have each night when I lay my head on my pillow and I can wake up the next morning knowing that I am right exactly where God wants me to be. The most important thing I've learned in AA is that I no longer have to be a lying, cheating, stealing, thieving whore. I no longer have to be that. Alcohol, there's a lot of things that I can't promise anybody and I can't guarantee anybody in this fellowship, but here's one thing I can guarantee you. For me, for this alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous may not have opened up the gates of heaven to let me in, but it damn sure opened up the gates of hell to let me out. Thank you.